I want to thank you very much for coming to this inaugural public lecture of the Humanitas Visiting Professorship in Economic Thought, which we're delighted will be given by Professor Sarpartha Dasgupta. I'm Vincent Crawford. I'm All Souls' academic director for the Economic Thought Professorships. And I just wanted to tell you briefly a little bit about the Humanitas program. It's a series of visiting professorships at Oxford and Cambridge, whose goal is to bring leading scholars and practitioners to both universities to address major themes in the arts, social sciences, and humanities. It was created by Lord Weidenfeld and managed and funded by the Institute for Strategic Dialogue in London. And our part is run in collaboration with Oxford's Division of Humanities. The Economic Thought Professorships are one of several different programs, mostly in the humanities. They're funded by the generous support of Dr. Donald Marin, and they're run in collaboration with All Souls College. So when we started to plan this, we wanted to find a speaker to launch the series whose work was both a good illustration of the depth and power of economic thought and was directly connected to human well-being. And not unimportantly, we also wanted to find a speaker who was capable of communicating his work to a general audience. If you know many economists, you'll know that these are very stringent criteria. And we asked for independent suggestions from a few different people. And there was one name at the top of all of our lists, that is to say, Professor Sarpartha Dasgupta. He's the Frank Ramsey Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Cambridge, a fellow of St. John's College, Cambridge, and a professorial research fellow at the Sustainable Consumption Institute of the University of Manchester. He is an economic theorist of exceptional power and range, whose work spans development economics, the economics of technological change and social capital, population economics, and as will be illustrated tonight, environmental and resource economics and welfare economics. His work is distinguished as much by its unfailing seriousness of purpose as it is by its clarity and depth, and much of it touches directly on human welfare. His work has brought him enormous recognition, and because time is limited, I will just tell you the one important thing he hasn't won yet, which is a certain gold medal given by Swedes in October in memory of the inventor of dynamite. After tonight, you may feel you have inside information on this event, but if you go to Ladbrokes in the fall, you will have an opportunity to bet on it, but you'll find, I think, that the odds are disappointingly short. In any case, Professor Dasgupta's topic tonight is the ethics of intergenerational distribution. Tomorrow, we're having an all-day workshop, which continues tonight's discussion on a sort of more technical level, with two master classes in the morning by Professor Dasgupta, one in the afternoon by Professor Sir Robert Watson, who is DEFRA's chief scientific advisor and professor of environmental sciences at East Anglia, and one by Professor John Broom, who is White Professor of Moral Philosophy here at Oxford. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Professor Dasgupta to Oxford.
Well, thank you very, very much. It's you should know that never trust the German professor of political economy at Oxford. He exaggerates. But it's a great pleasure to be here. I haven't had much contact with Oxford since the time of when Professor Ian Little ran considerable parts of Nuffield College Economics, which was, of course, a great deal of economics in the world. I'm sorry he is not here, and I'll have occasion to mention some of the inspiration that he created in many of us. The subject of my talk today is not unrelated to his interests. They emanate from them. Now, there is a sizable literature on humanity's impact on nature. It ranges from scientific studies of specific resource bases, for example, fisheries, wetlands, the atmosphere as a carbon sink, via such overarching reviews as the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which is published in 2003, 2005, that period, to popular accounts that summarize those findings and conclude that humanity is most likely to go down the proverbial tube. On the other hand, there is a prominent literature, Matt Ridley's book 2 years ago is an example of it, that studies episodes from history and contemporary economic growth to conclude that the worries expressed in the former literature are misconceived, because technology can be relied upon to save the situation. The problem is that neither set of studies offers an analysis of the processes that characterize humanity's exchanges with nature. The former literature, for example, doesn't produce reasons why the system characterizing human nature interchanges isn't self-correcting, while the latter literature doesn't offer any reason as to why that same system is self-correcting. And what I want to do is to use this lecture, this occasion, to develop a language for thinking about the processes that characterize our relationship with nature, our interchanges, daily interchanges with natural capital, or with the environment around us. 2 weeks ago, the Royal Society produced a significant report, I think, called People and the Planet, which gave a state of the world account of at the interface of population, consumption, and the natural environment. It's a state of the world account. It's pretty exhaustive. It's written by experts, so it's believable. But it, too, doesn't quite address the process at work. And what I want to do is to look at one part of that report, that is to say, the consumption-environment relationship, and ignore demographic matters, and see what processes might be involved. And my conclusion is going to be that the system is not self-correcting, unless, of course, there is collective action at various levels. And it's very hard to convey in one lecture the fact that natural processes, just as human processes, operate at different speeds and at various spatial scales. So in some sense, one has to massage the account by moving from the very small, maybe a village pond in Bangladesh, to district level accounts through a nation. And sometimes, of course, if you're thinking of global climate change, you think about the world as a whole. There's some similarities in the processes. The very fact that there's scale matters. Time matters. Some are very slow, some are very fast, some intermediate. Nevertheless, there is a commonality in these processes, and what I want to do is to dig into them. Now, obviously, when one says there's commonality, you're already picking some aspect of the process and focusing attention on it. And I'll be doing that. What I'll be doing is to talk about the nonlinearities that are involved in these processes. That means these are processes with possible positive feedback. Not necessarily for the whole, for the indefinite expansion of the process, but enough in some situations to cause possible problems of tipping phenomena. We observe tipping phenomena at various levels. If you have a garden and a garden pond, you will find in June or July, August, wake up in the morning, it's clear, pond, in the afternoon it has become unclear, eutrophied. It's a pretty fast process, 2-3 hours, and it'll have changed its characteristic. That picture you could carry, if you like, for thinking about nonlinearities in general, of the kinds that we are interested in, these ones with positive feedback. And what they will do is to accentuate the effects that I'll be studying here. I won't have very much to say about nonlinearities. They'll occur in a couple of examples that I'll mention. You'll spot it. You can see how it might lead to it. But that's not what I want to talk about. I want really to talk about human-nature interactions, in particular about our consumption motivations. Right, so let me see if I can work this. Yes, I can. People evaluate economies for prescribing and assessing, which taken together involve five sets of questions. A, how is the economy doing? We do that all the time. How has it been performing in recent years? What should our forecast of the economy's performance be under business as usual? D, how is the economy likely to perform under alternative policies? And E, which policies should we recommend? Now, I want you to think as citizens here. I mean, I want you to, we are thinking of problems concerning human nature interactions as citizens. We don that citizen's hat, usually first thing in the morning while having breakfast and reading the newspaper, because we don't like what we read, and most very often we don't like it, not because it goes against our personal interest, but because we have a sort of a benign attitude to the world and the world's going to hell, and we worry about that. Then, of course, we go into our private mode, maybe, and that's right and proper, otherwise we'll never get anywhere. I want you to think about that moment when we are thinking as citizens and reflecting on the state of the world. Now, questions A and B direct us to assess the performance of an economy, whereas questions D and E are prompted by our need to prescribe policy. C, and let me remind you, what should our forecast of the economy's performance be under business as usual, is the benchmark around which D and E are studied. You have a forecast and you say, well, the government is choosing this policy, which is wrong. It should be doing instead something else, and you're, of course, perturbing the economy by thinking about the alternative policy and presumably suggesting that that's an improvement on matters. The coin with which we as social evaluators assess and prescribe is intergenerational well-being. I will not have to go into detail as to how to think about it, except there will be a pause when I'll wish to address, I think, PPE students here. That'll be only for 3 minutes. But I don't want you to think that I'm going to get away without writing down an equation. That wouldn't be right. Okay? Now, sustainability analysis is prompted by questions A and B. How is the economy doing? How has it been performing in recent years? In some level, sustainability analysis is the focus of attention mostly of international organization publications like the World Development Report, the Human Development Report. If you look at the back pages, you will see tables telling you what the world has, how the countries have shaped up over the past 10, 20, 20 years. That's pretty much A and B. Of course, D and E are the prescriptive parts, while policy analysis is prompted by D and E. The customary indicators that are used for addressing those questions are, of course, the most familiar is GDP, relative to population size. We usually divide and talk about per capita, but I'm not going to go into inequality issues because the level of abstraction that I'm following here, that's pretty easy. You have to just expand the space on which you're evaluating by including people of different categories and then redefine GDP with weighted prices for people, and that'll be handled. That's the weakness of GDP lies elsewhere. Human Development Index is a linear combination of GDP per capita, life expectancy at birth, and literacy. That's very commonly used. And these days, the World Value Surveys have made life satisfaction data quite very popular. And we sometimes use that. When I say we, I mean social scientists in general. None of the above captures intergenerational well-being in the sense that we're interested here in not only the well-being of the current generation, but of our descendants, our children, and by at least recursion, given that we are interested in their well-being, presumably they would be interested in their children, so by recursion we are interested in our grandchildren. But of course, you may say we don't need this recursive argument because we are looking at the problem as social, as citizens. So we naturally will be thinking about our descendants. And I'll come back to these issues. The problem with all these three are that these three indicators is that they are really not far-sighted enough. GDP, the rogue word in GDP is gross. It doesn't handle the depreciation of capital. It says gross natural income, doesn't say net. So you could have a growth spurt in income while mining your, say, natural capital, or wear and tearing down your buildings, for that matter. And it wouldn't quite show. And if it doesn't show, then there's something wrong with it. I wouldn't go into 2 and 3, the other two indicators that I've just given you, to remind you of the way we typically make these assessments and evaluations, but you will notice that they will have similar problems. I can be critical of them because I have an alternative to offer, which is totally kosher. It's based on a theorem, so it can't be debated. I should say it's based on a correct theorem. But estimation is a different matter, and a great deal of work is going on in that direction, and I'll be speaking to it. This is my reminder to PP students. So those of you who are not, think about something else for 2 minutes. I said intergenerational well-being. What is that object? The one which we economists used most frequently is given in equations 1 and 2. And for the more philosophically minded, you see over here, looking at dates are S and T. Today is S equal to T equal to 0. U is social well-being at date S, which is a flow. So U is a flow. All right. Intergenerational well-being is a stock. It covers the whole lot, us and our future people. And the two most popular forms are 1 and 2. The first one is essentially, the first one is Henry Sidgwick and Frank Ramsay's classical utilitarianism. Ignore G, just call it 1, and regard delta as 0, and you've got it. You're just adding up the well-beings of all generations without any discounting. Okay? That's the Ramsay framework. An alternative formulation, which has a very different ethical underpinning, philosophical underpinning, and that's something I want to discuss tomorrow in the masterclass. Although it looks the same, I mean, a colleague of mine would say, well, one is a special case of the other, set delta equal to 0, and you get it. Well, that's not quite true. You need justification, and there is an alternative ethical framework. The classic work on this is due to the late Jarlene Koopmans of Yale, and that allows for discounting. But broadly speaking, we're thinking about a formulation like this. Now, I won't go any further into this issue. That's the detour I had, but I will be elaborating on it tomorrow. Now, the most important thing is that the theorem does not depend on intergenerational well-being. Have either 1 or 2. It could be much more general. It's a very general theorem. It's an equivalence result. Okay, now 1 and 2 have been put to use in both sustainability analysis and policy analysis. It's the common thread in most of welfare economics. The latter is a familiar notion, but what about the former? What does sustainability analysis mean? In this classic report on Our Common Future, 1987 publication, the Brundtland Commission defines sustainable development as development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. Now, the definition suggests we should seek to sustain something like the productive base of the economy under review, because you talk about the ability of future generations to meet the needs. So it's something like the factors of production, something like the stuff out there which can churn out whatever it is that we care about. Okay? So those are the hints, if you like. In which case you ask, what might the productive base be, whatever that object is? And the following suggest themselves. 1, manufactured or reproducible capital, buildings, machinery, roads, and ports, which are the commonplace machinery in economic models. In recent years, human capital has entered the lexicon in a big way. I'm going to include numbers here, but education and skills, tacit knowledge, and of course health. A person is a person is a person, but the quality of the life that a person can lead depends on certain inputs into that person. So you could think of the person as capable of transforming goods into goods, then human capital is the embodiment of that, those inputs, food and so forth in early years. There's a big literature on that, as you probably know, and it's extremely important. Knowledge, art and science, I'm thinking of knowledge separately from tacit knowledge. I'm thinking of public knowledge, codifiable knowledge. But look, these classifications are of no great moment. Basically, you want to cover the stuff that matters, okay? And for practical, empirical work, it does matter. The ways in which you try and estimate, for example, human capital, skill formation, and so forth, will be somewhat different from the way you estimate changes in the knowledge base, okay? And so those who are economists and work on this kind of field will know exactly what I'm talking about. Those who don't will recognize, nevertheless, that there is a distinction between tacit knowledge or knowledge embodied in a person as opposed to the calculus which is out there for us to pluck if we have the ability to do so. Institutions. We nowadays like to think of anything which has the whiff of durability as a capital asset. We talk about religious capital, we talk about institutional capital, cultural capital, and so forth. Vince kindly noted that I have worked on social capital, largely because I find this intangible stuff really rather fascinating, to see how to embed them into resource allocation processes which define resource allocation. So the rule of law, social norms, I'm going to be thinking of them as part of the institutions that engage the arrangements that enable people to live and exchange with one another. That's not an unfair way of thinking about institutions. That's another constituent of the productive base. Why is it important? It's important because you could, in principle, think of islands which are identical in A, B, C, and D, E, which is the natural capital. I don't need to elaborate on that. And yet one could have a bleak future, the other not so, dependent on the institutions it has been able to create. Okay? So these have distinct reasons. We have reasons for distinguishing them. And the E is, of course, natural capital, whereas how I come into the atmosphere, the oceans, ecosystems more generally. Okay? Now, we are interested in sustaining well-being across the generation. Is there a connection between the two? Notice what I've done. I've been talking about intergenerational well-being. We had a minute's pause to look at some special forms of intergenerational well-being, which economists very often use, and I'll be coming back to that. And then I talked about productive base because I was led to that by the Brundtland Commission report. One looks like the factors that enable people to get on with their lives, and well-being is about the achievement, being able to get on with your life, and is there a connection? And the connection, at one level, of course, it's immediate what the connection is. One is a factor and the other is the achievement. So what's the big deal? Well, here's the big deal, or minor deal maybe, but it's a deal, which is the requirement that an object should be sustained over a period of time means that it should not diminish over the period. I did consult the Oxford Dictionary to check whether I was right in thinking so. So assuming continuous time, we say intergenerational well-being is sustained at T if WT, which is intergenerational well-being at T, is not declining at T. So you have equation inequality 3. It's a local definition. You can elaborate on it. It's a local definition because it's at the moment T, it's not declining. But you might say, well, what about a five-minute process or a two-decade process? Well, you can just expand it, saying that at the end of the process, a period that under study, W is no less than what it is. Or you might even say that it should never be negative, should always be on a growing path. Okay? The idea is to evaluate economic change when the change is brought about by the passage of time itself. That's what sustainability analysis is all about. It studies an economy as it's moving through time under the institutions that exist, and you're allowed to consider the possibility that institutions evolve, that they may react to capital accumulation, that capital accumulation reacts to the evolution of institutions. You can have all that, there's not a problem. But once you have a political economy in mind, if you have an idea of a political economy, a conception of a political economy, you can track the economy and then ask whether WT is expected to rise over time or not, as the So you're assessing the economy as it moved through time. In contrast to policy analysis, where what you're asking is whether at a moment in time, if you change the policy from business as usual to, say, accepting a project or something, will that improve W? So you're freezing time looking at the shift in W as a consequence of some actions you commit yourself to at that date, whereas in sustainability analysis, the perturbation is the passage of time itself. That's the difference. So here it is. In contrast, a policy analysis introduced at T perturbs the economy at T. And 4, delta is to be read as the perturbation and the connection between these two separate types of analysis is that. Okay, so the factors determining well-being across the generations of the capital assets the economy has inherited from the past. Now you're doing your assessment at date T, which is, say, 2012. And you can be asking any of these questions, or any of the 5 questions that we began with. First 2 are about, say, you're looking into the future. Is the economy likely to be heading in a direction in which W increases over time? Or if it's under questions capital D and E, you'll be saying, well, here's a policy. Is that likely to increase intergenerational well-being now? Okay, looking into the impact of the policy over the future. Call the social wealth of an economy's productive base, that is to say its total set of capital assets, its wealth. Wealth is a weighted sum of the stocks of assets. The weights are known as shadow prices, which can be very different from market prices, and it's an issue that I'll be coming to right at the end. And they're very different in the case of ecological resources. The shadow price of a marginal unit of an asset is its contribution at the margin to intergenerational well-being. So the thought experiment you would be doing in estimating shadow prices would be the following. Suppose God were to drop one more unit of a particular resource onto the economy, then given the institutions, given the preferences, motivations of people, and given the capital assets it currently has, can you estimate what the change in intergenerational well-being would be if God were to throw a unit at you free of charge like manna? Okay? Whatever the answer is, it's the shadow price of that. And it is here that I would like to pay respect to Ian Little, because he created a great deal of the literature on shadow prices way back in the late 60s, I think, when he worked with Jim Merlies, another Oxford, and my teacher actually, in developing methods of social cost-benefit analysis. And there they were asking questions D and E. Social cost-benefit analysis of a project. So a project is perturbing the economy, and you're asking yourself whether the project is a good thing or a bad thing. And that's what they were doing. Now, in all this, it's important for me to emphasize that I'm not supposing that the institutions are in any way, that prevailing institutions or even the institutions that are forecast under the political economy that you read are in any way optimal. So I'm not talking about an optimizing economy, but it's important to know that you can ask welfare economics questions without thinking that you're already sitting at an optimum, in which case, of course, there's not much point in asking that question if you're at an optimum. So none of this presumes an optimizing economy. You could imagine that you're sitting in the Nigeria, you've sent a student there who is an honest student, and how is she to study the world? So these shadow prices are based on your forecast of the economy and then the way the economy is likely to react to the perturbation that you're inflicting on it. So that's wealth. Wealth is the weighted sum of the capital assets, and wealth is a stock, in contrast to GDP, which is a flow. Now, here's the 2 propositions. Proposition 1, intergenerational well-being increases over time if and only if, relative to its population, the economy's wealth increases over time. Proposition number 2, a policy change leads to an increase in intergenerational well-being if and only if, relative to its population, the economy's wealth increases as a consequence of the policy. So these are useful results to have, because you now have a unified method of thinking about welfare economics, doing welfare economics, And the object we would wish to use is wealth. The reason is that wealth, being a weighted sum of capital assets, is a linear index. So at the margin, what you'll be doing is, if you have somehow or the other estimated the shadow prices, you ask how the perturbation is going to change the capital assets. And you just add up the net gains. Some assets will be dwindling, oil and natural gas maybe, wetlands will be eradicated, but shopping malls will go up in size, in numbers. So the capital assets connected with shopping malls will go up, that's a plus. On the other hand, the wetlands gone down, that's a minus. You're going to add them up in estimated changes in wealth. Now, the interesting thing, and it's a darn useful thing, is that when we remember, it's change in wealth you're estimating. You don't really have to estimate wealth itself. It's change in wealth. In both of these propositions, it's change in wealth. And in order to estimate those, it turns out you don't really need to worry about measuring. You know, you might say, well, if wealth is the value of the productive base, you have to estimate the value of your institution. How on earth are you going to do that? Or the entire knowledge base. Well, you don't have to do that. You don't have to measure wealth. You want to measure the change in wealth. And for that, you don't need to know value the... I mean, you may be able to measure a change in something without your being able to measure the thing itself, if you see what I mean. And that's where the great advantage lies. And that is why we're able to do empirical work with Proposition 1. Proposition 2, we have been using it all the time anyway. Little and Merlise's method was to estimate the present discounted value of the flow of social benefits arising from a project, and saying if that's positive, project's good, if it's negative, project is bad. But the present discounted value of the flow of net social profits of a project is nothing other than a change in the wealth of the economy as a result of that project. So that's where Proposition 2 comes in. It's a reinterpretation of what we have been doing for a long, long time. Okay? So there has been a good deal of empirical work on Proposition 1. The World Bank has a series of publications on it now, on changing wealth of nations. Professor Kenneth Arrow at Stanford, Professor Larry Goulder at Stanford, and I, and two of our former PhD students, but now teaching, we have done quite a bit of work on this. And so there is a literature. But of course, it's amazingly crude stuff at the moment. I mean, I certainly wouldn't go to the gallows with any. These are very crude, but the thing is that we haven't really had an experience in estimating these wealth changes. Whereas in contrast, if you look at GDP estimation, it's got a 70-year history. It's been refined and refined and refined. But having said that, as a theorist, I have to tell you that I've come to the sad realization that when you see a number long enough, you start believing in it. So when you read that the GDP in Rwanda is so much, don't necessarily believe it just because every year it's published in the World Development Report. And the reason is that the way these objects are estimated are of necessity very crude, but because we are familiar with those numbers, we hear it, we read them every day, we think that they're accurate in some sense, in a way that wealth isn't. Okay, that's the setup. So the hard work lies, as I said, in trying to determine the social worth of the myriad of capital assets listed under A, B, and E. Crude estimates show that a country's wealth per capita can decline even as its GDP per head and HDI increase. And that's what we've shown in our empirical work. By the same token, it can be that a country's wealth per capita increases even as its GDP per head and HDI decline. As indicators of the long-run performance of economies, GDP and HDI should now be rejected. They have their uses, but not for sustainability analysis, nor for policy analysis, for that matter. Okay, so I've come to the last third of my talk. The estimates that economists, and that includes me, have offered of the social worth of an economy's assets, namely shadow prices, are highly suspect. Assets embody the potential flow of the factors that contribute to well-being, and the factors have been interpreted variously as being activities or engagements consonant with one's reason, projects, and purpose. And that's an Aristotelian view. If somebody says, what are the factors that drive well-being or generate or create well-being or a person's well-being. It could be objects, activities like friendship, going to the pub for a drink, writing poetry or reading poetry, if that's your taste, or many of the things we like doing and which are good for us. But the economist typically doesn't think along those lines. It sort of sticks consumption directly into well-being functions. So we think of, or many people think of, consumption being the drivers of well-being or the factors going into well-being. But because goods and services are necessary for one's projects and purposes, one really reduces to two. So this is, in some sense, a backhanded way of defending my profession. When we write down a utility function or a well-being function as a function of consumption, it's not crass. You could be saying, all right, it could be a second stage to a move in which you're saying, well, we are Aristotelians here, but, of course, activities require consumption goods. And if you can then spell the transformation of goods into activities and from activities to well-being, why then you've got a reduced form, which is what we work with. So denoting consumption by C, we have U, well-being at T, as U of CT. So the search starts with determining the drivers of consumption. Now, scholars have studied the drivers by variously asking, what is the human good? What do people care about? What do people say when asked how they are or how they feel? What considerations do people take into account when choosing? And lastly, what do they choose? You will recognize papers that you have read which have followed one or more of these processes. Sometimes we economists do find philosophers, moral philosophers, a bit trying, particularly when they bang on about the human good. Because at the end of the day, we, in a democratic society, you might want to ask what people think is the human good. And if that, how do you find out? One way is to ask them, of course. Another is to see what they do and then try and infer. So this reveal of preference approach, which is very much attacked by moral philosophers, and by the way, I have very many friends in the moral philosophy world, so I feel I'm entitled to be slightly critical of them occasionally, but that's because they're mostly critical of us economists, that is, for being vulgar. But at the end of the day, you've got to have some basis, and if you are a democrat, then you do want to perhaps take people's views into account rather than sit at a common room and dictate what the good life is all about. All of these are valid ways of thinking about it, and they should complement one another, and it's the complementarity which I want to emphasize here. So that's why I start with what is the human good and what do they choose. It is tempting to assume that one may move seamlessly from one to five, and that's where my profession is perhaps far a bit slick. Without acknowledging. But it's not A, by the way, it should be I. But the first is a deep question in ethics, and two is prompted by the need to understand human desires and aspirations, whereas three is about the responses people make to questionnaires, and four and five involve psychology and sociology of behavior. Here they are again. Now, the trouble is there are potential bottlenecks at each link in the chain leading from one to five, although much of the economics literature moves between them or among them without a pause. And now what I want to do in the next 5-10 minutes is to show you where we go wrong. My profession now. So, and there I have an authority. I can, because I've spent my whole life doing economics, so I think I can be critical. Remember, U depends on C, the reduced form. So how do you suppose you want to use reveal preference, that is the argument of type five, to try and infer, let's say not one, but two. You could say, let me look at five, and then I'll try and arrive at an answer to two, what they care about. And you could say, you're a Democrat, I don't care about moral philosophy, I'll ignore one. I'll just ask, what do people care about? And I want to know what they care about, because I care about that their answer. Okay? So I look at what they choose. Now here, the news is really bad. At least I was pretty, I don't work on consumption theory. But when I read it, I have to say I was not very happy. The economist's favorite model of the drivers of consumption is based on the beings and doings of a solipsist. a solipsist. I haven't got my word, my tongue around that. Solipsist. I think I've spelt it correctly. Solipsist. So the solipsist's well-being at any moment in time depends solely on his or her consumption of goods and services. And now let's think of a market economy, although what I'm saying can be easily generalized to non-market environments, okay? That's not a problem, but most textbooks will have this kind of thing. In a market economy, an individual's demand for goods and services is therefore a function solely of market prices and his income. So DEI is the demand of a person for commodity I, subscript I is the commodity I, and it's a function of P, which is a set of prices, goods and services, and I is the person's income, or wealth, doesn't matter. I mean, here I'm ignoring now time, just thinking of a person in the abstract, a timeless person. And that's a demand function, generated by the person's notion of his or her well-being. So that'll be driving, the demand function is driving choice, and we're going to try and infer the person's well-being from that choice, or those choices. The things that are, the factors that are influencing these choices are the price factor and the income. Now, one important departure from the standard, that's the standard model, would be to incorporate habits. And that would be to say that what has the person's experiences have been in the past. Now, of course, habits, it will be like a stock. It's happened in the past. You have no influence over your past. The past is what it is. It's a parameter in your current utility function. So if Z is an index of past consumption, the person's demand is now we can expand it. We can enrich the demand function by not only having prices, income, but also the history of the person's history. Now that might seem, well, it's not a big deal, so all you do is to parameterize a person by his habits. However, if you're interested in sustainability analysis, you're looking into the future. And the question is, day after tomorrow, tomorrow will have been a past, but tomorrow is today's future. So as you move through time, you're influencing the future. And one of the first thing you can prove when you introduce habits into these demand functions is that consumption trajectory is history dependent. It can be that other things remaining the same, if two economies had different histories, they would have two different future trajectories. It's a problem for the empiricist, but conceptually it's not a very problematic. The real problems come in the following observations. Departures from the solipsist model involves embedding the individual into society. Two types of motivation suggest themselves. We are both competitive, and we are also social animals. So I want to start with the social consumption, then I'll come to competitive consumption. I should say that the social consumption side of things, these ideas have been used to explain fertility behavior. And there's some now interesting empirical work to show how social effects influence fertility. But I'm concerned with consumption here. So the type of social influence has its roots in people wanting to belong to their group. Individuals don't want to be different from others in their consumption of such goods. The trick is going to be to find what goods are, and I'll come back to that right at the end. If C star of I is the average level of consumption of I by a person's peer group, then her demand for I in this expanded sense of a person is DI, as before, demand for commodity I is prices, income, and the average level of consumption of that good, C star of I. And with the property that the demand that the person makes is not very different from the average. So it's a bit like chasing your own tail. The average is, of course, endogenous. Because if everybody zooms onto a particular commodity and regards that as a social good around which he will operate when it comes to that commodity, then, of course, the average is going to be based on each person's expectation of that average. And then you, of course, look for an equilibrium of that. That's not a very hard thing to do, but that's what it is. For the individual, the average is a parameter, but for the economy, the average is not a parameter. And since the average is being influenced by each person's choice, you get the meaning. And the point at which it is a social good is that the demand that each individual makes is approximately the same as the average. Fads and fashions are, of course, the embodiment of this form of behavior, are examples of social consumption, as are religious goods. I like to think, in my own life, one of the most potent forms of this social consumption is in your peer group, and you have dinners you offer each other, you know, dinner parties, I guess. It's quite a common thing in our cultures. And in other cultures, too. There's not dinner parties, by the way, but it's other smoking pot and so forth. But here it's dinner. And you'll see the important thing is if you is you don't want to be very different. The dinner parties are pretty similar to each. And in fact, if the one thing you don't want to do is to show off. You'll embarrass your guest if you produce a exceptional menu, which you know is very expensive. And particularly the others know that it's very expensive. And then by, of course, you'll be embarrassing yourself because you've embarrassed your guests. So you keep to a norm. And which commodities become the focal points for this kind of behavior, what the level is, the level is easier to get if you know which commodities they are, because you can solve it as an equilibrium condition. We don't really know very much. It's after the event that we say, oh yes, hula hoops were obviously experienced that phenomenon, because everybody wanted to have a hula hoop at the time that hula hoop, and then it disappeared. So we don't know very much about it, but largely because we haven't actually studied it, or we mean we economists. So when individuals are moved by social consumption, the society can harbor multiple equilibria. That's another general result you can prove. And those of you who are studying game theory will know that these are games of coordination. It doesn't necessarily have to be waste, but bear in mind one clue we have to which commodities you might zero in on for social consumption, maybe on goods which are not excessively expensive. Certainly depending on your income class. Remember, they'll presumably be, since it's a peer group effect, you may be layered set of society, such that different commodities will appear as social consumption goods for different classes of people. But one possible clue would be they're cheap, relatively cheap. And that's where the externalities that appear in natural capital, the underpricing of, say, fossil fuels will have its mark. That is, it could well be that some of the way you reach these focal points are affected by the underpricing of natural capital. It'll be the last thing that I'll be mentioning. Okay. Competitive consumption. This has a longer history amongst economists because it started with Veblen, his work, or may have started earlier, but certainly he made it very popular, conspicuous consumption. There may be many motives behind this competitive consumption. Status is one of them. That's the one he put his finger on, but it need not be status. This is the beating the Joneses effect. So if C star I is the average level of consumption of I by a person's peer group, her demand for I is, again, the same functional form, things going into it, but where DI is now an increasing function of C star I. If others consume, the average consumption goes up, mine goes up, but in a particular way, I feel bad if mine consumption relative to the average is low. I feel better if it's high. That's a formally competitive consumption amounts to a prisoner's dilemma. Why? Because if you set this up in this most natural way, each is trying to beat the other, and you have another externality, but of a different character. And this has been studied. Recently, Ken Arrow and I wrote a paper 3 years ago at the Economic Journal, which studied some of the implications of competitive consumption. Competitive consumption can lead to the proverbial rat race. Everyone consumes too much and works too hard to earn the income necessary for that consumption. That's wasteful, especially if the goods on which competition is focused are resource intensive, automobiles, air travel, and the resources are underpriced. And in fact, the underpricing of these goods may well be a trigger mechanism for competing in them. Not necessarily. If you're super rich, you would go for goods which probably don't have any input other than the fact that some oil was used 150 years ago by some famous artist. But I'm talking about normal people, not for the social rich. It's often suggested, so you can see there are two sets of these externalities I've looked at, but they are consumption externalities. And they are both in the presence of environmental externalities that are driving the low price, causing the price of natural capital to be low to zero. There is a mutual reinforcement that takes place. If you write down a formal model, you will see an excessive encroachment of natural capital, because that's the easy one on which to do our thing. And our thing is being driven by, if you take these consumption externalities seriously into account. If you don't take the consumption externalities seriously, you still have a problem. And that's what we've been studying in economics a long time. Environmental and resource economics is concerned with that. It talks about the underpricing of natural capital, but softens the blow by not recognizing that, in some sense, our demand for goods and services are positively related to this underpricing in a way which is amplified by these externalities, the consumption externalities. However, as I began right at the beginning, it is often suggested that technology can be relied upon to come to humanity's aid. But new technologies do not come out of thin air. Innovators respond to incentives. Institutions matter. The underpricing of natural resources influences the direction of research and development. Because nature services are underpriced in the market, innovators have little reason to economize on their use. That is why new technologies are rapacious in the use of natural capital. The cumulative adoption of such technologies and practices over the centuries has locked us into an infrastructure that will prove very hard to dislodge. So the overall picture that I've tried to draw for you is one which cries out for collective action at various levels. I've tried to pitch the lecture at a rather general level. You can see its force at the very local, the village level, if you like, and you can expand it to touch upon the world as a whole. There are these commonalities, there are, of course, distinctions, goes without saying, but it's the commonalities which are of interest to the theorists because they concentrate the mind as to what we should be looking for. And this suggests that we have, if you add now to them that many of the natural processes suffer from our experience positive feedback, we have a problem. We have a problem because these forces are putting enormous pressure on natural capital. It's a finding which was stressed in the Royal Society's report on people and the planet. I think you might enjoy reading it, enjoy it in the intellectual sense. You may feel very depressed when you finish reading it, but that's a different matter. But the report is, as I said, a state of the world report. And for any such report, somebody will come in and say, well, all right, so what? Is there a Plato telling us what the right number of people is, or what the right demand on natural capital is? Why should we necessarily think these are very large numbers? And what I've tried to do here is to show that, yes, they are large numbers for reasons that the analysis suggests. Thank you very much.
We have a few minutes for questions. If you have a question and you raise your hand, the microphone will be given to you as if by magic. So, yes.
Thank you very much for the interesting talk, Mr. Gupta. You said that Kenneth Arrow and some former students of yours are actually working on very crude assessments of these shadow prices, which effectively should give us the true value of these sources of capital. And I was wondering whether or not you have these crude numbers just to get a good idea of the relationships between natural capital, institutional capital, physical capital.
Very good. Thank you very much for asking. I should say that they're not only crude, but they're also based on pretty bad modeling of demand. So none of these estimates that I've mentioned, none of the estimates, the World Bank certainly, or the Arrow et al. Paper, make use of these consumption externalities that I've wanted to stress here at the second, last third of the talk. Of course, that would make it, you would need a double whammy now. If you're asking about natural capital, examples would be, in the case of carbon, reasonable estimates. It's not unreasonable. Let me put it this way. Not unreasonable estimate would be $100 a ton in the atmosphere. Currently, they're way below. It's not unreasonable. And the thing to do, and this is something I think the Oxford School, Ian Little and Jim Merlies, perhaps didn't stress as much as they could have. By the way, I should tell you that the literature of the 70s, that is the on social cost-benefit analysis, which is where the shadow prices for the first time were developed empirically. I mean, there's some serious empirical research on them, too, but didn't have natural capital at all in none of the books. The Little Merleys didn't have it, and I'm ashamed to say the one I co-authored myself with another Oxford man, Amartya Sen, and Steve Margolin, our book had nothing on natural capital either. So it's, I don't know how it happened, but it happened. So none of these goods were there. But perhaps the one thing they didn't emphasize, none of these books, ours did emphasize a little bit, is that if you are insecure about the estimation, then I think the thing to do is to do sensitivity analysis in a big way. That's a very important thing to do. That you take low figures, high figures, intermediate figures, and see how whether the answer or a recommendation is sensitive to that. If it's sensitive, then it's bad news. You really have to fix on the number before you can make a recommendation. If it's not sensitive, you're laughing, at least for the range in question. But I don't see any other way out. And remember, these will be affected by uncertainty, which is not something I had actually mentioned, but it doesn't matter. For everything I wrote, you could have uncertainty brought in. That's not a problem. You would put a premium on these prices, a premium on these assets for risk aversion. Then, of course, it goes up some further. So for many ecosystems, for example, ecosystem services is the most neglected bit. I mean, we have very few estimates just evolving now, appearing at the University of East Anglia. There's been a major research project on ecosystem services and estimating shadow prices. But they're a horribly hard thing to do. It requires also collaborative research. You can't, an economist just can't go in and do it. That'll be just the wrong way of doing it. He'll have to work with ecologists, with soil experts, and so forth, hydrologists. And there is work of that sort that's going on. It's painstaking, takes 3, 4, 5 years, not very good for your tenure possibilities and so forth, but it has to be done. And I like to think a few senior people would help this along by perhaps not making tenure such a difficult thing for people willing to risk seriously interesting work, because the payoff is very high. You essentially open up new fields of empirical research.
In light of the historical dependence of consumption and the possibility for socio-technical lock-in, what more, in addition to changing the prices of natural assets, must be done to ensure intergenerational equity?
Very nice question. I skipped that, haven't I? Suppose you have the solipsist model, which is the standard model we have on which environmental economics is built. Okay. I'm not exaggerating, by the way, that's how it is. Then the public policy will be on the resources for which there are institutional failure, say open access or whatever. The externalities are there. They are environmental externalities. So the tax subsidies policies will be targeted at those inputs. But when you have these consumption externalities in addition, then you need a double barrel set of policies, not only on the factors going in, production of these goods, these natural capital, but also on the consumption side. So, for example, if it's a competitive consumption, it's a PD game, you would want presumably a tax on the good, right? Because everybody would prefer to consume less, but they can't unilaterally because others are running away with it. So you need two sets of public policies, two sets of taxes, one on the factors as well, one on the consumption side.
I have one, which you may wish to defer to tomorrow, but the proposition one uses shadow prices to evaluate wealth and uses wealth as an indicator of well-being. And it seems to me that a lot of productive changes tip economies into new areas. So, and you emphasize nonlinearities, and it seems like you could have two states where each state evaluated by its own local shadow prices would think it had higher wealth than the other. Is there anything like Proposition 1 that can deal with that kind of analytical problem?
That's a... I would expect that from you. I thought we were friends, but there we are. That's a really hard one. Okay, there are two types of things. One is if you're blundering along and then you hit a tipping point and you find yourself in a hole. And by the way, when I say tipping point, it doesn't mean catastrophe. By the way, tipping points, this has been experienced. This is not a theoretical device. If you know anything about rural life in sub-Saharan Africa or South Asia, you will find enormous numbers of indicators suggesting tipping points there when entire villages have to migrate. That's a tipping point, but it's happening at a local level. Usually when we think about tipping points, it's because in the popular press, it's all about the world tipping over or something. But at the local level, suppose the unit, the economy you're studying, which may be a village, tips over into a form where now the wealth has dramatically declined in terms of the capacity of the ecosystem, let's say, to produce services. Then, of course, you're now in a different regime and you have to recompute your shadow prices. So it'll be a bit like any story you tell, let's say, on optimum planning. Let's say you're planning, and now the uncertainty has smoothened these tips, let's say, because you've got a smooth distribution. But you know that there lies a tipping point, but of course you don't know where it is. It's somewhere in some region which you can specify, and you have a distribution over it, which smoothens the fact that, ex ante it smoothens it, because once you're there, of course, you've got a dramatic change. Now you're going along, so there's not a problem, you follow Proposition 1, right? So long as you haven't got to the tipping point. Yeah. Once you have, then you have to recompute your, re-estimate your shadow prices because you're now in a different, what's the expression? Attraction. Basin of attraction, that's it. So then you start, and then there's another tipping point, let's say, forecast, some other region, and some other capital asset. The same story will. So that's how I would think about it. So uncertainty smoothens things, as you know better than I do. And it's after the event that you then have to recompute.
Yes. So we want to thank Professor Daskofe again, but first let me say there is a reception outside and there's a stair to the right that doesn't look like it's leading anywhere interesting, but it really does lead to something nice. So let's thank Professor